There was one other little tiny building, and again, it wouldn't be more than 12 by 16, and that was our photographic detachment headquarters. Those were all the buildings, and the hangars were prefabs, World War I prefabs. They had a couple of hangar types that were used overseas in World War I. I think they were called Bezier hangars. Mm-hmm. One on which was canvas covered and the other was covered in sheet metal, but basically they were the same sort of thing. And you got the pieces and you put them together like a mechanical set and built a hangar. And these at the aerosol were sheet metal covered, mm-hmm. and fairly adequate, although they dripped a bit of water through them on the aircraft. That was it.
Were they big, large, tall ones like we know them today?
No, they were as high as you needed to get a... you see, you had the floats underneath the aircraft that made the aircraft stand up pretty well above the floats, and then the floats themselves would be 2 or 3 feet in depth. And then you had to have a cradle under the floats with wheels on it in order to...
They didn't have wheels built into the floats themselves.
They did later, but initially they didn't. And these aircraft that I was flying there did. So you had to have the doors high enough to get all that that height encompassed. Even so, it didn't make terribly high doors and terribly high hangars. But that determined the size of things, and these hangars could handle the flying boats and the seaplanes that we had. And the only other thing that in the way of a formal structure there, they had a slipway, concrete slipway, went down into the water, so that you could run your trolleys down the slipway and bring your aircraft onto the trolley and then use a tractor to pull the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. Or if it was a matter of putting your wheels on the floats. Those weren't built-in wheels. You had to put an axle through, through a tube in the float, you see, and put a wheel on each end of the axle on each float, and then tractor that up. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there was a little dock adjacent for boats. We had generally had a launch on every seaplane base, and then there was a little dock there to handle the launch. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
What about quarters?
But there were no quarters in those early days of Jericho Beach. And this applied to many of the bases of this type, other than Camp Borden and so on. You lived on the community. You had to find a place and rent a room. You were perhaps, some places they called it, you were a PG, a paying guest. And it amounted to that pretty well. You found a few, through good contacts, you found a nice family, you became a sort of part of the family. It had to be someplace within easy range, because very often you didn't have a motor car because you were temporarily in these areas. You had to be within walking distance or tram car distance or bus, easy bus distance. So there was no mess. You made your home in somebody else's home. And Jericho Beach had no mess for NCOs or officers in those days. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until some years later, in 1938, I guess it was, even perhaps early 39, but 38, I think, they started building new hangars at Jericho to replace the old ones. It would be 38. And squadrons are beginning to form. See, there was no squadron organization at that time. And therefore, new hangars, new quarters, barracks, office quarters, and messes became necessary. And at Jericho, for example, they didn't actually build a mess. They took over the home of Dick Spencer, Spencer Stores.
And they turned that into a mess.
It was a very big home. He was very friendly with the service, and he had reached the same. I can't remember the details, but at any rate, his home became available. Mm-hmm. and it became the officer's mess. And it happened to be within 4 blocks of Jericho Beach Station. It was rather convenient.
But tell me, being a PG, would you pay out of your own pocket partially, or would the Air Force pay your accommodation?
There was a small allowance called a subsistence allowance, I think, and you paid out of your own pocket. If you were living at a base that had office quarters and mess, then you didn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
So
it would the allowance be enough for you to get by?
Oh yes, it was a pretty meager allowance that you only paid about $8 a week or something, $10 a week.
And I suppose that would have been a boost.
You know, pay wasn't very great in those days. Pay of a pilot officer would be a little over $200 a month.
It was in the 1930s,
thereabouts. Yeah, in the 20s and 30s. It decreased in the 30s. It was a little over $200 a month in the 20s, and then after the crash, one's pay was reduced. You sort of volunteered to take a reduction of pay.
What sort of options did they give you?
You didn't have any options.
It's not like the present situation.
But it was sort of referred to as a voluntary reduction of pay.
Yeah,
the present day, people get very uptight about having their increase in pay slightly reduced. But in those days, there was no such a thing as increases in pay. You just took a flat decrease, and in our case, we took a 10% reduction in pay.
It's fairly obvious to anyone.
And there wasn't enough money available to pay. I was promoted to the rank of flight lieutenant in 1934. It was 34. But I wasn't paid. There wasn't enough money to pay me. I was flight attendant unpaid for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Would this all be added up and you would get paid eventually?
Oh, no. Nothing like that.
Not with interest?
No. Oh, no. Nothing like that. No. And that was a pretty serious matter. This business of getting promoted without pay was, in my particular case, and in several other cases, it was important to me personally, because the regulations of the day were that you could not get married until you had either reached the age of 30 or had become of the rank of captain or equivalent, and the equivalent in the Air Force was in flight lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
To go through the ranks of pilot officer and flying officer and get up to the rank of flight lieutenant in those days took almost as long as reaching the age of 30.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the Air Force at age 20. My prospect was that I would probably not be promoted till I got to be about 30. And to get promoted and then not get paid was quite serious, because still you weren't able to get married because you weren't paid. The basis was that you could not really live in keeping with the status of an officer and a gentleman unless you had the pay of a flight lieutenant or captain. So if you had private means, of course, you can get, if your CO would recommend it, you could get permission to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And a few, I think, did get married secretly and then got remarried later on. They got married without announcing it. But so years went by. See, I was I met my wife, my fiance, she was then, in 1929, early 29. I didn't get married until 1935, so it was 6 years, and even then, I got married without permission. And I decided that enough time had elapsed, and there were too many inequities and injustices in this thing that I would go ahead. The circumstances were a little conducive to it anyway. I was, at that time, I was in England doing a one-year course,
mm-hmm.
and the leave period was compulsory. It was a specified time. You had to take the leave in the middle of the course. Mm-hmm. So I was to be on leave in the month of August. Before I went over, and I already had been a flight attendant for more than a year. Before I went overseas, passing through headquarters, I went in and talked to the personnel officer and said, now I would like to know what the chances are and the prospects are of this situation being rectified, normalized during the year 1935, because if possible, I wish to get married in the month that I have to take my leave. I get married overseas and go on my honeymoon from England. Well, I discovered that the whole thing had been recommended in April, that this be rectified, and that there was no way of telling how long it would take, because it had to have formal approval from the government treasury board or something like that. So I didn't get much encouragement. In fact, I got a lot of discouragement about doing anything about it. So I said, well, I'm going to go ahead and get married in August.
Did you have the CEO's permission?
I didn't have a CO to talk to at that time. I was heading for England when made this statement. And in England, the customs are entirely different. You didn't have to go through this rigmarole either. So August came, and still I was not being paid in that rank. So we went ahead and got married, and done a month over the continent. And back, and in October, I got a signal to say that I was confirmed in rank with full pay, effective from April of 1935, and this was now October of 1935. But when I got back to Canada, I was disciplined for getting married without permission. I lost a year's seniority and severe reprimand and so on. I wasn't too surprised at that, but I wasn't. I was prepared if they wanted to discontinue my service, and that was quite all right with me. I was prepared for that. But,
did you know?
And I had a very good, your legal, the only legal counsel you would have on an occasion like that would be one of your fellow officers. Mm-hmm. And the adjutant camp, when I came back from England, I was supposed to Camp Borden. And the adjutant camp Borden was a flight attendant, Arthur James, and he was a very bright, capable fellow. And he acted as my lawyer. He accompanied me. We were still under the Army for discipline at that stage. Mm-hmm. And the GOC, the General Officer Commanding Military District, in Toronto, was the person before whom I had to appear. James put up a very good defense. I thought he was first class. The old boy just wasn't moved one iota. And he didn't make any errors in conducting the case. One or two of my compatriots had got clear of any punishment because the GOC had forgotten to ask them the important question, are you prepared to accept my punishment or do you wish to be tried by court-martial? Mm-hmm. And on two occasions, the GOC forgot to ask that question of other people. And that technicality got them clear and free. And they were therefore happily married without being penalized. All of these things to me were very unjust.
Oh, yeah.
And so I didn't give a damn what happened there. But it didn't really do me very much harm in the long run. Two or three of my... What happened was that... two or three of my friends were just below me on the list went above me, mm-hmm. because of my loss of the year. Four of them did. One of them became chief of the air staff 4 years before I did because of that.
Mm-hmm. That's what the reprimand became part of your permanent record. That's
right. Oh, yeah. That's right. But.
Well, tell me something. The actual procedure, was it a tribunal affair, or was it just one, the GOC, that you were presented in his office?
That's right. The GOC... and perhaps one of his staff officers would be present, and myself and my legal counsel.
He would have been briefed beforehand, I take it, the GOC.
Oh, yeah.
And he knew
He knew all the details. Well, funny enough, I'll tell you a funny sequel to that. Mm-hmm. That was General Elkin, and who was he was perhaps best known from having been a long time as commandant of the Royal Military College in Kingston. Mm-hmm. And he eventually retired in Kingston. And when I was in Kingston in the years 1951 to 1954, I was there as commandant of the National Defense College, not the Royal Military College, the National Defense College, which was at Fort Frontenac, mm-hmm. that very old and picturesque establishment. There's the autism at Fort Frontenac, right there on the shores of Lake Ontario. Tate DuPont Barracks. It was the site of Frontenac's camp, and when he came there in the very early days.
I've been told there's a very large oil painting in the Met done by Colonel Pope in town here. His wife has an uncle who painted it.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Supposed to be a very famous artist.
There were quite a lot of paintings made of that. I was there as an Air Vice Marshal, and we of course entertained quite a lot of the local people from time to time, and in the course of which we had the Elkins in to dinner, and they had us back on occasion, and we got to know one another a bit better. I thought it'd be amusing to tell him about this, remind him. Well, he was a little hard of hearing. I don't know whether he quite understood everything I said, but the story that I, but the recalling this incident, there's an absolute flaw. He might not have had any sense of humor, but he wasn't amused. I was in a position to be highly amused about it, but he wasn't. He didn't show any emotion whatsoever.
Didn't appreciate
the humor. No. Well, that was a strange custom, and it tied to denial of permission to marry. It applied to the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Could you understand the logic behind
it? The basis for it, well, it had some logic. The desire in those days was to have unencumbered junior officers who could be sent hither and yon at 5 minutes' notice. In my career, I've had information in the morning to say you're to be on the train at midnight tonight and en route to Vancouver or something like that, and I might be down in Ottawa. You got postings on that sort of basis in those days. It was convenient to the service to be able to shift you about without being cluttered with wives and families and possessions and things like that.
And don't forget that if you're married, you have to have a married quarter on base,
And of course, we were a very mobile organization. The nature of our activities in those days involved a lot of moving about, mm-hmm. and it was desirable, I suppose, on part of the authorities to have you as mobile. So that was one of the grounds. And the other one I mentioned, the fact that one was expected to live as an officer, a gentleman. You had to have the means to do that.
Do you have the means? Do you have an independent
I didn't have a private income. Mm-hmm. You really had to have a private income. Some people, some of my honorable friends in the service, I think, concocted a private income. Maybe their family had some means, but they weren't being given a regular allowance, but they had documentation to the effect that they had. So those things, you couldn't blame them for resorting to that sort of tactic, I guess, after years of waiting. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a little bit about promotion, or at least in passing or something else. Did you have to play politics to get promotion, or was it based upon merit?
Merit.
I suppose it was so small that everyone knew everyone else.
That is right, That's exactly it.
What about seniority? Was that as important as merit?
Seniority counted, but merit it would be a combination of merit and seniority.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Mm-hmm. Did it cause any resentment? Were you happy with it?
Can't remember any particular resentments. Occasionally, I suppose, there was the odd case, but not. Can't recall as much. And we had permanent force officers, and we had non-permanent force officers. Mm-hmm. In order to be a member of the permanent force through that period of the 20s and mid-20s through to the outbreak of war, you had to have a university degree before you could apply for entry. Mm-hmm. Indeed, for many of those years, you had to have a degree in engineering because it was regarded as a highly technical service, and that was considered a good basic qualification. And then as the years passed, that was broadened, so that we brought in other disciplines from the university. Mm-hmm. So, but when there was expansion more commitments more rapid than we could provide air crew to meet on that rather rigid and strict basis of entry, we did take in a number of people on a non-permanent basis. There would be, they weren't for any specific number of years, like the Royal Air Force. The RAF used to have what they call a short service commission, and you came in for a 5-year commission. It might be renewable. If you were outstanding, you might be taken on for another term, or you might be offered a permanent commission. Very small number were given permanent commissions from amongst the short service commissions. In Canada, we didn't operate on that basis. We took people on at the Queen's or the King's pleasure. You made your services available until such time as you're no longer required. And the opportunity for promotion amongst the non-permanents was not very great. It wasn't a career with them. And I don't know if I can think of anyone ever getting beyond the rank of flight lieutenant. But getting from flying officer to flight lieutenant, I can remember the odd case of sort of politicking and belly aching about promotion amongst the non-permanents. But I can't recall it amongst the regular force. Mm-hmm.
Was there any standard procedure in terms of years? It took 3 years to get to flight lieutenant, 3 years to get to flight.
Well, it took generally 1 year to go from pilot officer to flying officer. That's a, something between 1 and 2 years. But from then on, it depended upon the requirements of the establishment. You had to, if the establishment permitted it, you might get promotion in 4 years to the next rank, or 6 years, or 7 years, or 8 years. And also, as I mentioned before, it depends on the coffers, which the amount of money that was there. You see, the National Defense boat in those days was so damn small. Mm-hmm. And in the Depression days, was almost negligible. Now we went through 7 years, and there wasn't enough money to buy fuel to put in the aircraft for the pilots to fly. Only priority jobs were allocated fuel. Now, mine, even the photographic detachments were curtailed. Mm-hmm. In some parts of the country. I was one on a high-priority mission in those years. So the year I was up in the Queen Charlotte was one of the dead years, and some of the detachments in the East weren't flying because there wasn't enough money to pay for fuel. Pilots on stations were not flying in some places. They had to find jobs for young officers. I remember through my period of time on photo survey, I worked up into the position of being the, what you might call it, the key figure in the photo survey. And I used to go down to Ottawa and give the training courses in the wintertime to bring new pilots in and train them in the art and the technique of photo flying. And I can remember having a young officer assigned to me to deploy in any way I saw fit, except in the air. I could take him up as a passenger, but I couldn't permit him to fly. There wasn't enough money for that. And it was a little difficult to find work for a person on that basis.
So what would you do?
That officer was was Henry Carscallon. Later became Air Vice Marshal Carscallon. But he acted as sort of my aide and helped me with the odd tasks and menial jobs pertaining to the running of a photographic corps.
Mm-hmm. Would you just do it your own developing and printing, or would you just send the plates or the film?
We had a very well equipped photographic establishment in Ottawa. It was at Ottawa Air Station. It was built by the what do they call it? The National Patents given the task of running the relief camp, and the person who ran relief would work for 10 cents a day or something like that, with food and accommodation found, and that was one of the buildings constructed by the relief camp workers. It was a big, fine cinder block building, and was very well equipped to handle this job of processing. So all the films from all over Canada were sent into that point to be processed and developed. And they developed some of their own equipment. Canada was very much to the fore in this technique. They developed some good equipment in the handling and processing at high speed, these great big rolls. These rolls of film were about 100 feet long, you know. They're pretty close to 100 feet long. It took 110 exposures on a roll, and they were 10 by 12.
Mm-hmm. Would you be using cameras that have been used for reconnaissance during the war, or have they?
No. These were modern developments post-war. To some extent, they might have been based on the cameras used during the war, but they were entirely different. They were survey cameras developed by Fairchild Aviation Corporation, initially a photographic corporation in Farmingdale, New York. And some of the improvements to the camera came from Canadian contributions, but they were made in the States. Great big things, 65 pounds in weight. They're hardly heavy, awkward things to handle. They were very special cameras. And then, of course, they had a film pack that was removable. So that you carried... Generally, you carry 7 packs, one on the camera and six in storage racks. And all you had to do was to slide in a blanking plate. And then that would blank the light out from the exposed film. Mm-hmm. And then take that whole thing off with blanking plate, put it on the rack, and put another one on and pull out the blanking plate. And away you go. You could do that in seconds. Mm-hmm. And you had to do that. You had to do that on a photographic line at times. So you'd be going along the line, and you'd be taking, depending on the wind speed, whether you had it on your nose or on your tail, you'd be taking a picture every 20 to 25 seconds. Mm-hmm. And a light would come on, indicating when you were about to take a picture. And the camera operator was watching the meter on there, indicating how close you were at the end of the film. And as soon as the light went off, if you were at the end of that, close to the end of that film, he would have to do that within that 20 to 25 second period. Mm-hmm. And so he wouldn't have a break in a gap there. And they never, those boys never had a gap. You couldn't afford to have a bite of finger spell.
I remember the problem of taking a picture of that any film with the camera as it happens today.
Well, it's been known that somebody's forgotten to pull the blanking plate out. Not so much on the survey line, but see, we had, those were taken through a mount in the floor of the aircraft, looking vertically downward. But we also had a tripod mount, which permitted you to put the camera on the tripod and take scenic views out the side window. And we did quite a lot of that out here in B.C., in the mountain areas. We used up the ends of the films that way, very often. Instead of running the film right to the very end, you're never too sure whether the fellow who made that film actually made it precisely the right length. So you couldn't afford to run it right to the end. So we used to generally terminate the use of the roll at about 100 or 105 exposures. And that would leave anything from 10 to 15 exposures.
Depending
on the length. Yeah. So if we were in a proper locale and had the time, we'd expose those last two, just put the tripod up and just take some pictures of some beautiful mountain scenes. Glacier and one thing like that.
Did you ever get to keep any of them?
Oh yeah. Well, you could purchase them for 15 cents a piece. Yeah, and they're all on photograph. There's a catalog of every picture that's ever taken. All those things are numbered, you see. Mm-hmm. And named. The scenics are named. You take pictures of towns and villages and rivers and harbors. And stuff. Those are all in catalog, and you could order them then for 15 cents. I think man, they're probably about $2.50 a piece now. But you can still order. Them.
How's your voice, going?
Oh, it's getting a little hoarse, but
we'll get
to
the end.
Yeah, well, that's great. Stop it for a moment. I'll get a glass of water.
Well, the thing here is that perhaps we haven't discussed specifically what I want. I'm getting to know you, and you're probably getting to know me a bit, and perhaps you're a bit more comfortable with me. And hopefully, I'll be able to come back and talk to you again.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. That's fine, and we can do that. Is there anything else in the few remaining minutes that you want to ask a question about?
Oh, I know nothing of military law, except that I think that what you had to deal with was basically British military law in that period.
That's a pretty fair statement. We did have KR and ACI, King's Regulations and Air Council Instructions, mm-hmm. which were... It was generally referred to as KR Air. That's right, KR Air. And there was a military law manual written, and it was based. There was one for Canada, but it was based pretty well on the military law applicable to the Royal Air Force. Mm-hmm. And in turn, there was a great similarity between that and the equivalent books for the Army and the Navy. The law was very similar.
Anything you can remember about it, or any conflicts, any problems with military regulation, justice? You mentioned the one.
I mentioned the one. No, I don't think I can elaborate very much on that. There were very few. We had a really well-disciplined service, and the personnel in it were really, they were career people. They weren't short-term or something. No, they were there because they wanted to be there, and they were there because they enjoyed being there.
So you accept the regulations.
And everybody knew the benefits and the shortcomings, I guess, of military life and the regulations staying there, too, and you lived with it. Mm-hmm. There weren't very many disciplinary cases. Well, let me say, there weren't, to my knowledge, very many courts martial.
I'm thinking primarily of officers right here, or are you thinking of...
Well, I'm thinking of the whole thing, all right. You're thinking of officers, okay. It would be very rare for there to be court martial and officers in the RCAF. I can't think of a case in those years we're talking about. Mm-hmm. There might have been, but I just can't recall one. There were summary trials before one's commanding officer, or hearings, or trial. Trial is not the word that perhaps is generally used, but that's what it amounted to.
And would this be something that will be given a choice of either this or a court martial?
That is right. Yeah. You had to give the offender a choice. That was law. For example, if an offender felt that the charge was unjustified, or that the CO was being stupid or not interpreting the law the way it should be interpreted, now you might get a commanding officer who got a little bit screwy in the head. That's also a possibility, and you might get a charge that's quite unjustified. Well, in that case, an offender would be wise to too, the trial of the court-martial, because that really, in a sense, tries both the CO and the offender.
The only thing is, it brings to question so many things, and it also isolates the offender against from the rest of the service actually,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose it was more conducive to morale, to decorum, whatever. You have it done as quietly and as quickly as possible.
That's
the reason why most people chose.
Yeah. Well, generally the cases handled by the CO are fairly mild cases, and they wouldn't warrant a trial by court martial.
Mm-hmm.
Trial by court martial requires a pretty elaborate setup.
Mm-hmm.
And
for a service as small as yours was, it would mean bringing together so many officers at one given point, I suppose.
That's right, yeah.
And disrupt the service completely.
Yeah. And of course, every person on the involved on the staff of the president of the court martial would be intimate friends of the accused. And that again, in a small service, is perhaps not the best basis for a trial. But there would be lots of cases where. I shouldn't say lots, but they're the sort of cases that would come before a CO would be maybe an NCO would be up for disobedience or drunkenly disorderly conduct or absence of leave.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing didn't happen. We didn't have AWOL cases very often in the Air Force. I think you're more inclined to get that in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps with the Navy, because when the Navy got ashore after being confined for weeks on ship, it wouldn't be too surprising to find chaps getting a little out of hand and not getting back to their base on time. But it was rather rare and unusual in the Air Force to have cases like that. But that is the sort of thing that the CO would be dealing with. Yeah. But again, with the officers, they were reliable, responsible group of people, and they don't get involved with being absent of leave or that sort of thing. Failing to obey an order, failing to carry out their duties, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about peacetime forces, it's no different from wartime.
Well, you're career oriented.
I think we're done, aren't we? Are we?
Yep.
Is there anything? Are we just?
No, we still have a bit more to go.
Oh, I see.
But it's almost over. It's going to run itself right now.
Yeah, okay.
Well, thank you very much. We've probably
good.
Been right here.
Yeah.